know how, but I stumbled into an anatomy lecture, which had a laboratory component. And in that laboratory, we had real cadavers. You had this human body open with pins and needles stuck in the now no longer vital organs. But you had the diagnosis of what we are and what can go wrong and all the little parts. I tell you what, when I read these first three pages, I saw that kind of pinning so precisely different parts of, I guess, what he calls the self in relation to itself. I can't wait to see what we make of that.
Okay. Yeah, this is, I have a hard time knowing what to make of it. I think I got at parts of it, but it'll be great to shoot things off you guys and see what you guys make of it. But I think there's a lot there, obviously. So I'm just going to start reading and ignore what he has under A. Is that okay?
Okay.
Or do you think there's something there we want to discuss? Okay, yeah.
I want to say one thing. I think there is one thing that we could note, his repetition of the word despair in that, as a kind of obviously a theme for what we're going to be reading. So one question I put in the back of my mind is, all right, he says in pretty much jargon-laden language, being unconscious in despair of having a self, not wanting in despair to be oneself, and wanting in despair to be oneself. Well, my mind takes out the word despair as his key. We'll see where we can go with it.
Yeah, okay. So it starts like this. Man is spirit, but what is spirit? Spirit is the self. But what is the self? The self is a relation which relates itself to its own self. Or it is that in the relation, and it says in brackets, which accounts for it. That relation relates itself to its own self. The self is not the relation, but, in brackets, consists in the fact that the relation relates itself to its own self. Man is a synthesis of the infinite and the finite, of the temporal and the eternal, of freedom and necessity. In short, it is a synthesis. A synthesis is a relation between two factors. So regarded, man is not yet a self. Okay.
I understood all of that, obviously.
Say again.
I understood all of that, obviously. Easy.
Yeah, easy peasy.
Easy philosophy.
You're a bit unclear, Robert. Can you do something about that?
Yeah, one second, actually. I'm going to have to move upstairs.
Okay.
Okay. Give me a minute.
Oh, yeah, iPad.
I mean, it's clear as mashed potatoes.
That's pretty good.
This first paragraph.
Yeah, I think the third paragraph is worse than this one.
A question, I don't want to pose it too soon, but I guess I'll pose it right now. Some people, maybe myself included, have regarded this first paragraph as a long-winded joke.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
He considered himself the gadfly of Georg Hegel. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to get through some of Georg Hegel's books. They're so dense for me. There's one called The Phenomenology of Spirit. And it's pretty much that kind of language. There's a thesis and antithesis, and they relate to get a higher order synthesis that's about ready to become a brand new thesis.
Yeah.
So I wonder if Kierkegaard is joking or if he's serious.
I mean, the first book of Kierkegaard I read was Concluding Unscientific Postscript. And that was a difficult book to read. And then afterwards, I was reading a commentary or something, and then somebody said, you know, this book was actually intended as an extended critique and making fun of Hegel. Like, a whole book is just poking fun at Hegel. So, but to get back to this paragraph, so what I see him saying here is, So he's saying that the self has this duality within it of the finite and the infinite, and then there's a relation which brings them together, and this is the synthesis. And now, one thing I was confused about is he regarding the relation as sort of a third entity, or is the synthesis sort of this dynamic place where the finite and the infinite sort of continuously intersect and change? So it's ever shifting, the relation. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
So what do you guys think?
I want to give the floor to Robert, because I'm still, the bubbles are still coming to the surface for me.
Yeah, it's pretty rough, but I think he's doing it on purpose. Like, the Hegel thing is definitely, I'm pretty sure it's true. He is definitely poking fun. However, it's not a complete joke in the sense that he's not saying anything. I think, well, it doesn't say it in this paragraph yet, but what he's trying to drive at is that man is not simply the relation between the infinite and the finite. I guess we'll get to this, but he's the relation to that relation. If that makes sense. He's one step higher. It's kind of weird to think about, but I guess another way of saying it might be, I think he says it this way in another book, I can't remember where, that man's not simply aware, he's self-aware, if that helps. I don't know if that helps at all.
Yeah, this reminds me of something. So I was listening to Verveke today talk with one of his co-authors in a book he'd written, and he actually brought up Kierkegaard. And one thing he brought up with regards to this quote is that it's sort of the distinction between the self that can look at itself, but then the self that's being looked at. So it's sort of the self-reflective self, but then the self that's being reflected upon. So that's part of the distinction there.
Yeah.
Okay. Indeed.
That's helpful.
So as if we're running, in terms of synthesis, two parallel tracks, the one of what that synthesis looks like, and then the other, I think the butt end of the joke, I'm sorry, it's hard for me to let this go, is when he says, in my translation, I think it's the second to last paragraph, the penultimate, he says, from my translation, five words. In short, a synthesis. If you were an academic contemporary with Kierkegaard, you probably would have been on the floor rolling in laughter, or you would have been scandalized, because in short, a synthesis took Hegel books to arrive at the synthesis. And Kierkegaard just says, oh, by the way, to be brief, it's a synthesis.
Well, I don't think any of Kierkegaard's contemporaries were rolling on the floor laughing, because I don't think anybody got what he was talking about.
I think it'd be kind of like someone in a math room who is rehearsing an argument, like rehearsing a really famous proof that takes like 2,500 steps to prove, and just being like five steps in, yeah, and you all know, and then just like the conclusion. Exactly.
It reminds me of the old Jewish prophets, rabbis or whatever. They would get in these long arguments, and then one of them would, and they wouldn't, like, they would sort of quote Bible verses to prop up their position, but they wouldn't say the entire thing. They would just say, you know, like a single word. So like they would say the tree, and everyone would know what the tree was, and that would make sense, and that would sort of be connecting this whole interconnected world of of biblical texts, and just that's the type of argument they would have that would be completely incomprehensible to us, because they're just using these fragmentary sentences that everyone knows what they're talking about, and everything is, yeah, it's just that kind of thing.
I love that you brought that up, because for me, like, wide frame, like Robert said, the Kierkegaard liked to take the elements out of other people's philosophies, like their not their keywords, but the words that they would use offhand, and make those offhand words his key terms in his philosophy. So he could have his cake and eat it too. He could develop something and poke fun at the other people's systems at the same time. So for Hegel, you started as an individual and then you did more complicated things with your philosophy. Kierkegaard was like, no, I'm going to do very complicated things to now arrive at the individual.
Yeah.
And Hegel's like, that's where I started.
I just love the Hegel references in concluding on scientific postscripts. He'll go like, at one point he says something, and then he has this delightful little quote. At this point, the Hegelian will fall upon my breast, crying out at me to whatever, like just these types of references. This passionate Hegelian just falling on his breast with deep pathos at what he's just done.
And I don't mean to say that Kierkegaard is orthodox, because historically he probably wasn't, but when he says at the end of this paragraph, a synthesis is a relation between two terms, looked at in this way, a human being is not yet a self. It reminds me of this monk, contemporary monk with us three, who is on YouTube trying to rebuild a monastery on an island somewhere off the coast of Europe. His name is Father Seraphim. Anyway, he said in one of these videos I watched when he was talking about prayer that his axiom or principle is that he wasn't a person yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And part of looking at, say, icons or praying, keeping vigil, or maybe the three of us talking and trying to work through this icon of a book, I promise I'll stop soon, he was trying to approach being a person, right? An intact thing, and not like a ball of confusion trying to figure out where to point its attention over the long term. So when Kierkegaard says, looked at in this way, this kind of synthesis, it's not yet a self, a kind of concern for what it means to be a human. I mean, the first sentence, the human being is spirit, seems to want to tell us everything we need to know. But in the last sentence of the paragraph, it admits that it hasn't even begun to tell us what a human being is yet.
Ah, yeah. I thought what he was getting at there was the notion that you're still, the fact that there's this dialectical tension between the finite and the infinite means that you sort of never cease to develop. Right there's always this tension, which is what that's what I thought it was driving at. But you might be right, because he does then get in deeper into what he means by the self in the upcoming paragraphs.
I definitely see that too.
Yeah.
And as you said, maybe that's our segue into the next one.
Oh, you're not done with this one yet.
Oh, really?
I'd like to dive into more of what he means by this tension between the finite and the infinite, the temporal and the eternal, freedom and necessity. One way I have of thinking about this is the notion of the actual self and the ideal self, where when someone asks you a question like, you know, those survey questions where someone that's trying to determine your personality or something, and they'll ask a question like, the way they would phrase it is, it would be something like, do you treat people kindly or something like that? And part of you wants to say, I didn't phrase this well, but part of you wants to say, you know, I don't always treat people well, but my other part wants to say, you know, it's something I value deeply, is treating people well. So there's this tension in me where I don't know, is the self I act out my actual self, or is the self I want to become, which represents my most treasured ideals, my actual self? So that's one way of understanding the tension that I see. I wonder if Robert or you, Matt, could maybe show some other ways of thinking about it that help you. Or
that sounds right, but yeah, I'm struggling to find another way that the idea of a human being, because it seems like what he's talking about there to be a when he says the infinite and the finite, or the temporal and the eternal, it seems to me that he's talking about, like, you know, body, human being as a you know, animal, and human being as an idea.
Yep.
The problem, of course, is, like you said, there is always a tension. But I think it might be a higher level of tension than what you were talking about, where you're not living up to the ideal. That might be a little higher than what I was thinking, which is basically just, you know, human being as what the word human being implies, you know, like an idea rather than simply a thing. And I still think this is more Hegelian stuff, because he just lists them all off. He just goes, human being is a synthesis of the infinite and the finite and the temporal and the eternal and freedom and necessity. So he just lists them all off one by one. And like I think what Matt was saying, things that Hegel would have written, it would have filled books with. He's maybe one sentence is good.
Do you have anything to add, Matt? Because I could say so.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Robert on that. It's like Kierkegaard, he's doing the ethical argument in this paragraph while being a trickster. So I want to, all right, so rhetorically, he's giving us the ethical argument. I know my terms. I know my system. He says in Fear and Trembling, through a pseudonym, not Anticlimacus, but Johannes de Silentio, yeah, that I'm not a purveyor of the system. By that, he means the Hegelian system of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, roughly speaking. I'm instead just some normal guy with my own ideas. But here, the person speaking, the pseudonym, I would argue, is saying, I understand the system. I know the categories, just like Robert said, freedom, necessity. I understand they're opposed, seemingly, right? I get it. I'm in on the joke. I'm one of the inner circle academics looking at these things. But at the same, so that's his ethical argument. You should believe him. But at the same time, he's the trickster archetype. He's coming in and he's undermining it as he's paying it lip service.
Yeah. Subversion.
Yeah, but when you were talking, Julian, about the ideal self and that rational self, or the self that enacts principles, mm-hmm, I thought of Cain and Abel.
Okay, say more.
Yeah, so Cain and Abel, maybe archetypally or however we want to phrase it, could be seen as two extremes in some sense, where they both want to serve God, right? They both want to be where reality is. They both want to be instantiated. They want to be true, but the one is free because he does the right sacrifices, Abel, and the other one is constrained. Or maybe you want to reverse them, however you want to think about it, necessity. The one makes the proper sacrifices, whichever one the one is, and the other doesn't and is called out on it. And because it will not come over to the other side, but stays as it is, it kills the other. And so that's a dualism. And I just thought of that. Like, that was I tend to think in pictures. So when you were talking abstractly, to my mind, I had to generate that illustration.
My Kierkegaard books are full of little doodles like, well, something like this. I just draw diagrams.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, this is me trying to understand the cell. So I have like model A, where the synthesis is not a thing. It's just sort of the two things relating with each other. And the other one is like it's something. That's one thing I was confused about is the relation, like this third self.
Oh.
Or is it just a relation? Does that make any sense?
It's. What do you think, Robert?
Yeah, that's a good question. The next paragraph, I don't want to jump ahead again, but The next paragraph, he says it's a negative unity. And I've read this passage, I don't know how many times.
Yes.
I don't know what a negative unity is.
Me neither.
But it might be simply ideal. Like it might not be real in any sense. It might just be, you know, an idea. I don't know if that helps at all, but like I the way I understood it, what I kind of managed to distill out of the whole thing was, that whole passage was that it's not as simple as maybe the Hegelians, not necessarily Hegel himself, but the Hegelians would want to put it when they say that, you know, synthesis or thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right?
Mm-hmm.
The synthesis is the human being. There we have it. We got a human being. We got the idea plus the body equals human being. He says, no, that's not right. What you've got is you've got, you know, maybe a proto-human. And what helped me get there, I think, was fear and trembling, because the whole part that I really focused on is about the merman, and it's a psychological development. And he starts out as a proto-human. He starts out as something like an animal, and then he gets shocked. And who talks about shock? I think maybe shock is mentioned in this book. Oh no, shock is mentioned in either or.
Yeah, this is. The sort of the aesthetic, the ethical, the religious type thing, or
yeah, no, I was thinking of the one of the pseudonymous authors talks about shock as like something that knocks you out of your own consciousness, and Merman gets knocked out of his consciousness by a girl that he tries to seduce, and instead of resisting, she trusts him, which is so shocking to him that he gains self-awareness of what he is. And that step back from himself, that seems to me like the beginning of what a human being is. So instead of just being in the aesthetic where you're basically hedonistic more or less,
mm-hmm.
maybe highly, highly sophisticated, still hedonistic. And if you step back from that, if you get shocked out of that mode,
yep.
Seems to me like at least a start towards whatever Antichromacus wants the human being to be in the end. Maybe. I don't know.
This is interesting. Yes, yes, yes.
Same, especially when you apply it to the big five personality. So you could look at whatever you turn out to be, high in openness, myself low in very high in neuroticism as well for me, and think sure. That's it. And then try to model to Julian's point, a life after that image, that statistical average or image. But like you had said, all it takes is someone to surprise me out of myself. And then right there is where my life begins. Yeah.
Here's another notion. Have any of you read about Kierkegaard speaking of the moment or the instant, or I forget the Danish word, it's Einblicker or something like that. Have any of you read about the moment?
Maybe if you give me some context.
I haven't read about the moment, but
okay.
I'm getting this from, you know, I was reading a a friend of mine wrote a piece, like this creative piece, and you know, one of the key things in her piece was this notion of sort of the moment, and it's the moment is sort of this liminal space between time and eternity, freedom and necessity, past and future, and it's sort of this space where you're sort of pushed towards it by the past, and the past is sort of the necessity, and then you're confronted by the open future in a moment of decision. And I think this is part of what it's sort of this instant where you have to make a decision, but there's no real certainty. It's sort of where the road swings off and it's a decisive moment. And this is the place where you sort of chart your course into the future. And I just think of this in relation to Kierkegaard's notion of the self, where, you know, maybe part of what he's getting at is this past, which might be necessity, and then freedom. This necessity and freedom. Freedom is the open future, and then this relation between the two is something like the moment. Something like this.
Let me blow that up with just a few examples. Oh, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, like, this notion of the moment is sort of present in everything that makes life life. Like Robert mentioned, sort of this guy who just goes through the motions in his life. He's sort of this zombie who just walks through his life. Like the guy who's driving the car, and he's not even realizing he's not even conscious of the fact that he's driving. He's just driving. That's sort of the image. But the moment is when you're, this is where life becomes life, because it's when you find free will to chart your course. Something like that.
I totally agree with you. I've been doing this little experiment in my own mind to try to translate Jordan Peterson to Kierkegaardian isms, and I find that they find each other in the middle usually. But one thing Jordan Peterson talks about often is automizing or automatizing most things in your life.
Yep.
Right. The importance of routine and the benefits of habit, and then nevertheless, he gives a lot of credence to that divide in eternal, infinite divide between chaos and order.
Yes.
And like the necessity to freely stay the course, which may mean making a radical decision to live life as an adventure. So he'll say, for example, there is a distinct moment when you decide, okay, I will not be Peter Pan. That will not be my fate. So I must compress into a career or a job or a service. And then maybe on the other end, it reverse bottlenecks. But if I don't do that, then I will become by necessity Peter Pan. And he tells anecdotes of, you know, there was a time in my life when all I did was drink, and then I decided to get my act together. Very much a moment kind of anecdote that we all have. And then one other thing as an example of that, I keep going back to this, and Kierkegaard used him often, Don Quixote. As maybe not the word, maybe the word
and
is in prototypical Christian, but an exemplar of what it means to be a Christian, where most of your life is predicated on faith, right?
Yeah.
He is a guy who objectively was not a knight. I mean, look at him. He's making all these mistakes. He's sinning in his profession, but nevertheless, he has faith that he is a knight.
Hey, okay. Yeah. I'm starting to put some things together. So we have this aesthetic stage, which is, like Robert said, sort of this automatic, you're just living life without any thought. And at some point, this sort of has the illusion of freedom because you're just doing what you want, hypothetically, but you're really just running after your desires. And at some point, you're going to run into unfreedom because your future closes off. There's less, you know, if you spend your life chasing your desires and you end up doing heroin and pot and smoking weed or whatever you decide to do, your future is going to constrain itself. So this is where we get into the ethical stage where you put some limits on your life and you, and in that way, though you're constraining yourself, the freedom of the future opens up again. And I think maybe this is where you get into fear and trembling with this notion of faith as a venture into uncertainty, because now he's suddenly taken this sort of this radical following the calling of God, where he sort of reintegrated this aesthetic freedom in a sense, this chaos from the aesthetic maybe, into the ethical life. Is that, Robert, what do you think of that? Because you spent the most time in fear and trembling.
I wanted to maybe talk a little bit about Don Giovanni types. I don't think it's quite that they're zombies. They're sort of like that, but it's more like, I think he said somewhere that they want to project their voice out into the universe and hear their own voice coming back at them. So basically, the reason in the story of the merman that this innocent girl defeats him, but with her innocence, is because he is expecting her to resist, because he's done this a million times before, and it's always gone the same way. He approaches it, he's this merman, he seduces girls on the seashore. He does this over and over again. He seduces them, he brings them into the sea with him. Maybe they drown, it doesn't matter. The point is that over and over again, he does the same thing, and it always works out the same way. Johannes the Seducer, in The Diary of the Seducer, I think it's called, an either or, he's basically a sociopath, more or less. It's a sort of a creepy story when you read it, but it, the same thing happens. He takes interest in the girl, and then he follows her around or whatever. He tries to approach her in different ways. He basically milks the situation for all it's worth for his own psychological gratification, I guess, a certain feeling. And then he's done, and that's it. Just does it again. It does it again with another girl. But if anything ever happened, if any of those girls acted differently, like unpredictably, then it would all be over. He would be knocked out off the track, right? And again, I think that's the kind of thing that it takes to get someone who is, especially a sophisticated hedonist, to get a person like that off of the track of the aesthetic and into something else. And just to tie up a little bit, I think that Kierkegaard thinks that the religious is the marriage of the aesthetic and the ethical.
Yeah,
I think so too.
Wow, that's interesting. See, this connects with, yeah. It's interesting. Wow. Hmm. Yeah, I've heard him say that the ethical and the aesthetic are retained in the religious.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
things get complicated with religiousness A and religiousness B, which I've always found a bit confusing, because as far as I can tell, religiousness A is sort of the nominal Christian type or something. And I would think that should just fall into the ethical instead of being a separate category. Or am I missing something with religiousness A?
The way I sorted it out in the end in my research paper was that religiousness A is sort of, it's not necessarily Christianity. It's a sort of, I can't remember who I was talking to the other night. Maybe it was you, Julian. I think I was saying something like it's a resigning of the world, it's a giving up of the world kind of like a monk, or very much like a monk, pretty much like a monk. Exactly.
Can I interrupt? Is this the night of infinite resignation in fear and trembling?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
So he's talked about it in different ways, but I think basically the night of infinite resignation is more or less a monk. That's probably the best image. And instead of receiving the world, I'm jumping ahead again, but instead of receiving the world as a gift, as the Knight of Faith does, and that's why you can't really see him, because he's living in the world just like, you know, everyone else is. The Knight of Infinite Resignation steps back from the world and gives it up as lost, which the Knight of Faith also does, but then he receives it back again as a gift.
Wow.
I think that's probably the difference. The Christian monk is not necessarily what resignation has to be. I think like anything like, you know, like the Buddhist monks and whatnot, I think there's Taoist monks as well. Just any kind of figure that removes himself from society in order to in some way stay pure, right? You know, to keep away from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And to focus on some kind of a relationship with God, actually.
Yeah.
There's something false in the relation, of course, because it's not complete. It's not they have a pretty good conception of what or who God is, but not a very good relationship with God. Maybe that's a good way of saying it. I don't know.
Hey, we're going to have to restart this because we're running out of time.
Oh, yeah, I see that.
So let's just hang this up and just get right in, because I'm sure Matt has a lot to say on that.
Yeah.
Okay.